the Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have with me David Gann, who is the co-author of Double Helix Water, Has the 200-Year-Old Mystery of Homeopathy Been Solved? David and his partner, Shuo-Ying Lo, who is a PhD in physics, have a fascinating story to tell, one that many of the authors we interview here have in common. What happens when you are out there bleeding on the cutting edge? Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Well, David, you want to tell us a little bit about how you and Shuo-Ying got started in this adventure that you have been on for the last, I don't know, what, 20 years?
Close to 20 years. It began probably late 93, 94 era, and Yen had a project that had come from the University of Melbourne. Mm-hmm. Yen had been a senior lecturer there for a number of years, and he'd come out of basically national laboratories. Prior to that, he was he's got a very formal background. He came out of the University of Chicago. He did his PhD under the theory group under a man who got the Nobel Prize in physics, a man named Nabu, and his sort of person he grew up in high school with and came with him. They both went to college at University of Chicago. That was Daniel Tu, and Daniel got the Nobel Prize in physics in, I think, 98. Another classmate came out of the same high school in Hong Kong, went on to be the Fields Medal mathematics winner. They don't give a Nobel Prize for math. That's kind of the top prize in math, and that's a guy named Yao at Harvard. So Yen had a very strong, he was a theoretical particle physicist and still is. But I ran into him. He had a project that was being moved to Caltech in the mid-90s, and it was a particle beam. So we had met over that through some mutual people that we knew, and I got to know Yen, and he's a delightful guy. And I liked the work he was doing. And during that time, though, I had stumbled on a particular water sample that puzzled us. We didn't know why it was doing what it was doing. It had a strange effect to it. And we were just fortunate at the time that, Yen was around. And this project at Caltech had an awesome bunch of people that were working. Alfred Wong was there, and he won the Clerk Maxwell Prize in Physics, and another guy. Yao was helping from Harvard, and there was a man that literally made that was the original guy on the atomic bomb project for China. He was there with us, and so we were working on a dissimilar project, but all of a sudden I stumbled over this water sample, and we began to investigate what it was in that water that created the effect that we saw. And did I lose you?
No, I'm here.
Oh, that's all right. I don't know how much detail you want to give, but
I want you to talk about how you looked at it, because that was exciting.
Well, the first thing we did is that it was given to me by a person that told me he had no science background whatsoever and mm-hmm. wouldn't tell me what he was doing. And he'd given me a number of samples. Some of them worked, and one of them worked, and four or five did not work. And mm-hmm. so first thing we did, we just analyzed the water, and it just came back. It was distilled water, and it, had tiny little traces of stuff you normally find in distilled water. You find a little tiny bit of calcium and phosphorus, and sometimes a little magnesium. But these are just absolute trace amounts and parts per million or less. Mm-hmm. But nothing that would, because we were seeing a catalytic action of this water, and it had some strange kind of electrical properties to it. And so we couldn't figure out why this was occurring, because we couldn't find anything in the water.
Right.
And A friend of Yen's there at Caltech, a guy, his name was Sunny Chan, suggests that we do a nuclear magnetic resonance, which is kind of a forerunner to an MNR, MNR in a hospital. And so we looked at the water, and it had a strange peak to it. It wasn't perfectly water. There was something in it. And so we kept investigating, doing more and more tests and more different types of tests on the water, looking at its properties, like if it was different dielectric properties. In other words, did it have the same resistivity that normal water should have? Does it also have the surface tension? Was it different than normal water? And we kept coming up with just a slight difference. And so Yin's a mathematician. I mean, he came out of a high school basically first, and then went on to University of Chicago. But particle physicists, especially theoretical particle physicists, are extremely strong mathematicians. And so he just said, well, I have to know everything there is about water. So he spent a couple of 2-3 weeks doing a serious study, reading all the literature that he could get his hands on water, all the different papers. Mm-hmm. And he came across Debye. Debye was a man who got the Nobel Prize back in the 30s, and he was he wrote the definitive set of equations on what happens when you put something in water that goes into solution. And he really wrote the math model on, like if I take salt and I put some salt in water, what's going to happen? Well, water's going to separate that salt into sodium and chloride because the bond's not very strong and the water acts as a wedge, gets in between it, and pushes it apart. But since one particle's got a plus charge and the other one's got a minus, they're going to try to collide, and they collide and water pushes them apart, and they collide and water pushes them apart. But since you got lots of salt in the water, this is going on. It's kind of like a big ball of activity that's happening. But Debye calculated, well, what happens as you continue to dilute? And he did it down to about a part per thousand. And he wrote the math on and studied, you know, the relationships of these particles at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So what Ian did is the final set of equations are called the Debye-Huckel set, and he took that set of equations and took them out way past to where Debye had done so.
Right.
He took them out to about one part per million.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for about a week or so. He had a big office there down the hall for me, and it just had all blackboards in it, and I'd walk by there once in a while, and I'd look in there and kind of make my head spin to look at all the math he was doing. And then one morning he ran into my office and he yelled, you know, I know what it is, I know what it is. And I always tell people he honestly looked like a mad scientist that morning. He was his hair was all kind of, you know, in a strange part. And he had this look of joy in his eyes. And he says, I know what's in the water. And I said, well, what, Yen? And he says, there's a particle. He says, come in here. And then he drew out on the blackboard the shape of the particle, the size, and it showed that it was made up of smaller particles, and those particles were made up of smaller particles. But he drew out the first one, and he says, look, they're going to grow. They can grow this big, and which was about a micron in diameter by 3 microns in length, and they'd be rod-shaped. And he said, that's as big as they'll grow, but they'll be very polar, and he says they'll connect to each other. And so that's where it started. That would have been 95, I guess. And and a couple of years later, the first one we photographed, which was in up in Santa Barbara at a company called Digital, they were one of the first makers of an atomic force microscope. Sure enough, the first one we finally found was exactly that size and shape. And the more we studied the particle, the more we found out that the math model really had predicted it all in the beginning.
So really what Yin did was take the dilution into what is done in homeopathy, which is like a million or even more dilution, and started studying, which evidently had never been studied before, in theoretical physics, the mathematics of that.
It's been used
in homeopathy for many years, but it never really studied.
Yeah, homeopathy, and the people have just, when we first published, there was a couple of papers. There was one paper in 96 that Yin wrote. There was another paper that came out of UCLA. We were just, I hate to say it, but we were just shot at and attacked for 10-12 years, saying we were just trying to prove homeopathy. Yin and I, neither one of us had a clue what homeopathy was prior to this work.
That's right.
We were not
trying to prove anything like that.
We were not involved in homeopathy. Matter of fact, you could have asked Yin what homeopathy was at the time. He would have looked at you with a, just like a deer in a headlight. He would have had no idea. But the thing that kept we were kept linked to was a paper that was published in Nature in 87, and numerous people at Caltech, when we got on this line, began to say, "Oh, you shouldn't do this, and you got to be careful." And Yin's a famous guy, and he's going to get destroyed, and blah blah blah. And again, we didn't know anything about that paper either. That was a paper written by a guy named Benvenista, I think it was Jacques Benvenista, and he was a French researcher, and he had stumbled over the same phenomena but he was evidently was a serious person in homeopathy in the study of, and was trying to come up with some idea of why it was occurring, and he'd done a famous experiment where he'd, and it was published in Nature they kept it in the paper in that journal for about a year, and then they withdrew it, saying they shouldn't have put it there. It was bad science, and they must have been drinking the weekend they published it.
I know all about that. I know all about that tactic. Just a little side comment here. I wrote a book called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, which, of course, is going after another sacred cow of not the pharmaceutical, but the implant device companies, who are all connected, by the way.
I'm sure they are.
And a colleague of mine published a paper in Analytical Chemistry on the effect of platinum, which was used as a catalyst in the making of some breast implants, and its effect on health. And later on, I don't know how later on, I know in Nature it was 1 year, but the same thing happened. The powers that be pressured the publisher of Analytical Chemistry to do a similar retraction. And what's interesting, when scientific journals do this, they never even consult the authors of the paper that they're attacking or they're wiping away. They're never even usually allowed to rebuttal, which is very interesting.
Well, we found that we ran into an effect at, again, we were not looking for any health kinds of ramifications of this particle, mm-hmm. but we were looking originally for catalyst. So my background prior
engine,
to meeting
right?
Yin was mostly in catalytic metals and microelectronics, and when we, I just happened to photograph one afternoon over at Caltech. I had the use of their equipment over there, and they had an electron microscope, and I was taking a photograph of this particle, and I noticed a bug on this sample that I had prepared. I went, "Wow, this guy's kind of interesting." I was bored, and so I started taking a picture of this bug, and then all of a sudden I went, "Whoa, look at this. These particles have ruptured the outside membrane, kind of this protein sac of the bug," and I went, "Wow, isn't that interesting?" I went, "Well, that's why I've never seen any bacteria grow in this water, because I've got samples that are 10, 15 years old that have been in, there's no chlorine in the water, and they've been exposed numerous times, and they've never had bugs in them." And so I go, "Well," so it made sense that the environment was too active. The little particles were too highly charged, and as the bug moved around, they and sort of just stuck to the side of him, and eventually he would the outside membrane would break. So I showed this to a friend over at UCLA who was working with me at that time, who is still working with me now, and we were working on a catalyst. And I said, look at this. And he goes, wow, well, this is fascinating. And he says, what is this? And so I described him. He says, well, come on. I says, I've got a buddy over at the medical school here. And he says, come on, let's take this over and show it to him. So we went over, and that was Salem Sinkin. And Salem was the chairman of the chemical engineering department. His buddy was a guy named Benjamin Bonavide, who was a researcher there in the Department of Immunology, and he was the head of the department at that time. So what we did is Benjamin asked me about it, and he said, what is this? And I said, well, it's a bug. And he said, oh, no, I know that's a bug, but he says, what are these things? And I said, well, those are tiny little particles or water. And I said, and I described how we made them and this and that. And but interesting is your comment just a while ago. He said, well, what did you make these out of? And I said, well, they're made out of water, but I said, you have to have something that's going to trigger this this whole mechanism of how these particles grows, and you need a single charge particle of some type. And I said, I've used a platinum ion on this. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, platinum. He says, well, that's interesting. He says, you know, he says, platinum is one of the few things I've ever seen to that will stimulate a T cell. But he says, you know, it's really toxic to the body. So the body doesn't like platinum. He says, mm-hmm. just 50 parts per million, and you got problems with your liver. And he says, it's just not a good thing to play with. But he says, it'll wake up a T cell. And he says, how much platinum's in this? And I said, oh, I said, you'll never find any in this. I said, I don't know. He says, part per billion, part per trillion, maybe, I don't know. But there's going to be almost no platinum. You'll be lucky to ever find a platinum ion. So he said, well, let's try... let's do some studies on it. So we did like, 57, and they were all double-blind studies. They were all on live cells. And we found across the board that these water particles just lit up the board with these. A T-cell a dormant-type T-cell all of a sudden would wake up and secrete a cytokine, and the cytokine mm-hmm. that it would produce would be one of the interleukins. And the placebo would do like nothing, or maybe 1 or 10, or I think one placebo did about 100 or 200. All these started in the thousands and went to the 7,000 and higher. So it was just, it was a remarkable, really fine. But I tell you, when it was published, it was just absolutely, it started a war between us and some unknown faction. And... but for years, you would put either my name or Yen's name into the internet. We were total scam artists, and mm-hmm. you know, we won it in 10 states. And the company that we'd done this was just a you know, a front for another area, and it was just all the whole thing was a scam. And you'd never gone to school and didn't have a degree, and God, it just went on and on and on.
Yeah, the internet really does allow the busters to go crazy with the misinformation.
Yeah, and then you get all these other people coming on the internet,
and they do.
All of a sudden, they just love to destroy your character. But really, from day one, we've just been in this for one reason, and that is our love to know things. And mm-hmm. Yin's entire life has been in theoretical particle physics, and mine's mm-hmm. mostly been in real practical engineering, but
right.
it's always been in research. I've been in, 5 or 6 labs in my life, and, you know, in every one of them, mostly I built and built all the equipment in it and built the high vacuum systems and did a lot of early research into IR detectors and a lot of fiber optic research when it was first starting. So anyway... our backgrounds came together. I was mostly skilled in making extremely clean environments. And one thing you need for this is a clean environment.
Right. That's very important. You had also used structured water to decrease carbon deposits in engines and in with the oil industry.
Yeah, and we're still doing doing that, and we're trying to we're making some pretty good inroads right now, and I keep on telling all my guys that we have to make sure all our sort of ducks are in a row before we walk down that oil industry line, because that's a pretty big line also. And but yeah, we published a paper also in, I guess, 96 or 97 from out of UCLA, that we showed that like in this we built a reactor there at UCLA, which was a used for cracking or dividing hydrocarbons to make polyethylene bags, eventually, like the stuff you see at Walmart where you go in and they bag your stuff. And
right.
In order to make that, you make a an ethylene chain, and so there's, I don't know, this is gargantuan amounts of that being made across the planet. But the big problem with that is that it is so dirty to do so. You create a ton of what's called coking in these reactors that make these polyethylene chains. And so one of their biggest problems is maintenance. And so Salem and I said, Salem Sinkin, and we said, well, the thing to do with this, let's do some experiments. And right off the bat, we showed tremendously significant reduction in carbon. I mean, we went a factor of four right off the first paper. And so we know that, you know, there's a lot of applications in the oil industry for a clean catalyst that causes a lower combustion temperature and doesn't affect the atmosphere. The problem with almost all additives out there are, you know, there's a lot of additives that work, but they also create another emission stream. And what you got to do is you got to get to a point where you don't add anything into the emission stream and you reduce the emissions, because we dramatically need to get out of, you know, putting emissions into hydrocarbons don't do well with in the air, because eventually they end up in your, you know, end up in your body.
Yeah, my brother is the president of Aerodyne Corporation, and his company produces devices that measure air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Mexico City, you had mentioned, you know, south of the border, the emissions are terrible, and we all share the same air.
Yeah, it's
Mexico
the problem.
City,
you know, you get down there and you think, well, it's in Mexico, but you know, I worked in Mexico for Mexico City for a couple of years, and I worked with the Minister of Interior there. Well, we were specifically trying to find clean water and clean up the air.
Mm-hmm.
And the water was so dirty underneath that city that it was at 900 feet. We were finding water that still couldn't drink, and
right.
And the air was just unbelievably filthy. And problem is, that air doesn't stay in Mexico.
It doesn't.
You know, it comes right. You know, it comes right up. Somehow, it eventually ends up in the atmosphere that's surrounding the planet. So it just goes everywhere. So you got to clean up all sources, not just one source. You got to clean up all sources. And the third world countries and countries like Mexico City, they are making strides. They finally put, you know, they didn't have catalytic converters on their cars until, I think, the 90s sometime.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going, oh, well, at least we started in the 70s trying to clean the air. But they're working at it, but we need a long ways to go.
There's a lot of problems. Now, your structured water, in terms of the health benefits, I know that Dr. Norm Shealy did a study for you and kind of quantitated exactly the cytokine being released in a patient population, which was...
Mm-hmm.
It's a clinical study, which is good.
Well, he actually used students. I mean, these were all healthy people there at his institute, and so we need a lot of studies. I mean, we don't understand why these people are getting well, and we've had a ton of people get well, and I got to, you know, make a.
Well, I have a whole patient population that has immune deficiencies from
mm-hmm.
Chemicals in silicone. Because they've ruptured or leaked, and so they've got pretty severe immune problems. They also have high cytokine levels, like they have high interleukin-2s, but they don't have, their immune deficiencies are specifically in the T-cell category. So they get, you know, fungus, yeast, viruses, and cancer?
Well, you know, I think I'd say probably 90% or more, or at least 85% of our problem is toxicity. It's got to be. I mean, it doesn't make any sense that you've got a human standing in front of you that's got 3.5 billion years of genetic engineering get sick. He's at the top of the food chain. He eats everything. And the whole planet is nothing but everything eats something. And we seem to eat everything and we survive. So how come we're getting all of a sudden so ill? And I look at the fact that, you know, if you... I threw out one day trying to make sense of it. I looked at if you put a tape measure across a football field, that's 300 feet, 100 yards. And if you take every inch of that, would be equivalent to about 1 million years in the evolutionary time as far as when protoplasm started. And then I went, well, look at that. You know, for all the way across the football field, we've survived. So I said, well, when did we really, when did this big change happen? And if you look at the last inch, well, the last inch all the way across the football field is going to be the last 1 million years. Well, what's in the last 100 years? That's really when we've just created about 100,000 new chemicals in our environment. And that's, you would have to, if you pull a hair off your head and put it across the very end of that football field, it would be too much. You'd have to cut that hair into about 50 pieces. Uh-huh. And then you would be looking at that last little sliver. And that's, we've just changed everything. We've changed, you know, as far as, you know, man comes along and says, oh, let's, all this new...
Let's have an industrial revolution.
Yeah, you look at that. You know, all of a sudden we're like kids in a candy store or the damn chemical factory. But you got to understand those.
It's okay though, because if the experiment goes awry, we'll just disappear, and somebody else will come up. And maybe they'll be smarter.
Yeah, but I got to thinking. Well, Mother Nature is kind of, she's got an edge to her, and the bottom line is, finally somebody makes it through, and then all of a sudden they're a new species. Now they go around and with their heads in the trash cans, looking for all the chemicals in the paint cans and toxic pharmaceuticals, and they look weird, but everybody else, they're on a barren planet. They're one out of a trillion. So, I think we need to rethink our and, always says, well, you can't get so bent down on chemists. No, I'm not down on chemists. Chemistry is, came from physics, but it's basically, but it's also... One must be responsible for one's actions. One, when you introduce a new chemical into the environment, we really need to know its long-term effect.
Right.
And so
it's called
our
the precautionary
is
principle.
I'm sorry?
It's called the precautionary principle.
Yeah, and you need to have a fundamental understanding. So that's why we're so excited about this water particle, because I actually think this particle is a very beginning phase of protoplasm, and I know people. I'm going to be shot for that statement, but I actually think it's a genesis phase of water in which it was the first time that water went solid, and so it had literally just a new geometry to it, and it had a plus and a minus because it's very polar. And so it's got to flow in a direction, and it wants to combine with another particle and then another particle. And it appears to be a way for this whole mechanism that we have as we stand here as a human body that's really, I believe, is very, very electrical. And it seems like it's the beginning of that whole sort of evolution. So we need to understand it. I mean, it's very critical to understand that first geometry, because that's kind of like the first piece of code. It's kind of like if you're writing a program, you got to understand where you got to know the fundamental basics, and you got to know that first bit of binary code. And then from there, you can almost take a program apart and you can figure it out after a while. Oh, look here. Oh, he's using the same code over here and here and here and here. at, but it all comes from that first understanding. And that's why we just need to understand this particle. And from it, I think we might get a lot of answers.
Yeah, the stories where they looked at where people live the longest in the world, and then they looked at the water they drank, and it was being microclustered with some silica. So the microclustering of water has, you know, in associating with longevity and health, has gone back an awfully long way.
Yeah, it could, you know, it could be. You know, I sometimes wonder if that's just the fact that they were so removed from, you know, modern society that they, you know, they're just living
didn't
out.
Have the chemicals.
Yeah, they're living in a very clean environment. You know, my parents both lived on a farm in Missouri, and they seldom left there, and they grew their own food and had their own beef and their pork and chicken, and everything was on that. You know, they both lived into their 90s, and they were pretty healthy when they died. And so I look at that a lot of times going, well, these guys were very removed from, you know, sort of our modern society.
Right.
And but it's very true. I mean, the thing that we see with this, you know, there's a lot of information on clustered water. Well, mostly these are flickering clusters. These are, this is how water bonds, as in different geometries. And but this is actually a solid particle. We made enough of it in 2009 for the publication in Physics Letters that you could actually you can see it. You can hold it. You can take it a little. Just a microscope slide and hold it up to light with your naked eye, and you go, "Wow, what's that powder all over this stuff?"
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you analyze that powder, and it says it's water. So, how can there be a powdered water at one atmosphere and one, you know, at normal, you know, temperatures?
Well, you explain that in your book.
I'm sorry?
You explain that in your book.
Yeah, and that's a. That's the thing, you know. It's a new stable water cluster. We call it would be the sort of the scientific name for it. It definitely is a new discovery of a state of water. And people say, well, why do you call it double helix water? Well, for some reason, as over the years, as we've learned to concentrate this particle more and more in water. That and we photograph it. Then all of a sudden, on our photographs, we start looking and we go, "Holy smokes! Look at this! Stuff starts forming double helixes."
Mm-hmm.
When you concentrate it and continue to concentrate it, the more concentrated you get it, you start seeing double helixes, and you go, "That's weird." And well, it has to be because it has a. It's just the bonding, how the particle will bond. It wants to bond. The particle looks a little bit like a little soccer ball, and it wants to bond a particular way. And so it will only bond in either direction, but it bonds in a spiral. And then on the other side, it will bond in an opposite spiral. So you go, wow, that's very fascinating that this water forms double helixes. Mm-hmm. And so consequently, you know, so we call it the name double helix water. But
well, there is a theory that David Wilcox has, I guess, put forth, and he probably got it from other sources, as he does most things, but he puts things together in a kind of interesting way. And this theory is that the frequency of life is literally a frequency that is projected into all of these different solar systems and systems, and then when they get to a point where there's water and other things that are compatible with that, then life spontaneously occurs. And
well,
this would seem to fit into it.
I mean, it's not all that far-fetched. I mean, you just from the viewpoint of you're always looking, how does it make the jump? Because you watch this stuff grow in the lab, you swear it's bacterial.
Right, yeah.
Wow, this stuff looks like bugs.
You
look at the water and you know it's in the water and you know it's in an unbelievably clean environment and you can sample it from now to doomsday, and you'll not find anything in it. Mm-hmm. But yet, this stuff just wants to multiply.
Right.
And so there, it's almost like a transition from matter to life, but it's like the sort of in between there. So is it a frequency that comes along and bam, and pulls that one hydrogen off there and sticks that, mm-hmm. you know, carbon and nitrogen on there, so you've got an amino acid? Could be, you know. In the end, it is all frequency. The bottom line is that, you know, there is nothing in this universe that doesn't have either a plus or a minus or a push or a pull or a reach or withdrawal or a, you know, it's all binary code. It's you know, people say, well, how can you say it's buying a car? That's, you know, it's ridiculous. That's a computer. No, all the universe is nothing but a binary code. It's plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, minus, minus, plus. You look at any kind of configurations of how things bond, it can all be broken down into a one or a zero or a plus or a minus or a yes or a no. You can write a binary code from it. And when somebody tells me that, you know, all life is frequency, it all started with frequency, I look at that and I go, I can see how that would work. and even so, I mean, I don't want to step on anybody's toes on religion, because people say, well, God did it. And absolutely, could have, you know. It's okay with me. You know, you got a supreme being, and he's mm-hmm. the guy who's putting the intention down. That's fine. I don't care. And, it can all, this guy in my lab here a few weeks ago, we had to put in some new deep wells around the lab for some heating systems. And the guy's evidently a devout Christian, and said, you know, he really likes the water, he's been using the water, and telling me he's given it to lots of his friends and telling me results and things. And he said, there's a passage in the Bible that talks about where God came to the earth and all that was there was water.
Right.
And he says, this works really well for me.
Yeah.
I said, fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
And we're not trying to create any conflicts. All we're doing is studying a water particle, and it just has some. Last 5 years, people have shown up at our door and with all kinds of crazy illnesses. And again, Yen and I are not physicians. We are not MDs. Now, we got a full-time MD on our staff, but
right.
the reality is, these people just get well, and they don't get well because they're being given a drug or they've been given treatment. They get well because their own immune system somehow kick in,
yeah.
And they just start getting well. And now, our interesting thing has been in the last year or so, actually longer than the last 4 years or so, mm-hmm. we've been doing thermal images of people. And what we were trying to figure out in the beginning is, why is there such a dramatic change with a thermal image when they, because
mm-hmm.
we just give them, we take a thermal image and say he's got a bad shoulder, he's got a bad arm, or he's got
right.
a bad knee, that's or something.
That shows up as heat.
You'll see a white spot there,
right.
A big white, and the white would be the hottest area. And
yeah, black is dark.
And black, and going towards blue is you know, colder and colder. So, but the white spot would be an area of real inflammation. Give them a glass of distilled water and take one 10, 15 minutes later, and there'll be no change. Give the guy distilled water with, you know, 10, 15 drops of this water in there, and all of a sudden you look at it, and the whole area will change. You go, whoa, so how did that happen? So, Yin's...
Along the meridians.
Well, that's what Yin says. Yin, and of course, he's Chinese, and he says, well... And he's also, you know, he studied Chinese medicine forever, and he mm-hmm. says, look, there are meridians, and basically what's happening is you are repairing all those meridians, and they're draining the charge away. And I go, well, could be, you know. I mean, you're somehow grounding that charge. You're dissipating
what
that charge
because
away.
If it was biochemistry, it would be slower. You're dealing with biophysics.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to be. Because of the time involved.
I'm sorry?
Because of the time involved.
Yeah, and that's what Yin's brother says. Yin's brother's a biochemist, and he's run a big lab for his entire life. He says this is not a biochemical reaction. Mm-hmm. He says too quick.
I don't know whether you and Yin have taken a look at the Keys of Enoch, but in that book is a chart that actually demonstrates how the Word becomes flesh, all the way from the frequency codes down to the RNA.
Hmm.
DNA and an RNA. It might be worthwhile taking a look at it, because that's really the mathematics of it.
If you email me the reference or whatever, I'd love to.
I will. It's a Keys of Enoch. It's a revelation book. It's not a it's not a scientific journal. It's something given by revelation, which of course is an interesting way to get things.
Yeah,
certainly a lot of the Bible is based on that. But it's very accurate as far as I can see, because I've studied a lot of biochemistry, biophysics, the whole spiritual how the manifested worlds come into existence thing. And that would be interesting. Besides the immune effects, that are mediated by the T cell studies, is there any other biological mechanisms that you've seen with the water?
Well, we have like I said, I've got a girl that works on the staff here with me that used to be a Mayo Clinic. She and I were friends through college, and she went on to medicine, and I went into physics. And she has a whole list of items that she believes this water affects. And she believes it's a cell-to-cell kind of communication type of phenomena, because the particle's so small. We're down in we're down in 30 nanometers or less, and. What I know about it is the particle has a big charge to it. I mean, we can characterize the charge by using an atomic force microscope, and I go, okay, well, it's definitely water, it's definitely this size, and it definitely has a charge. Mm-hmm. Now, how does that charge, or if it's pulsating that frequency, how does it, influence a cell? Well, I've got a guy in Florida, a guy named Dan Clark. He's a surgeon in Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale. He said absolutely it's a frequency, and the frequency is the original frequency of DNA, and it basically acts as a little sort of amplifier. He says it goes there and sits next to the DNA, and he says when the DNA divides, it pulls itself apart, and as it unspirals and then pulls itself apart, and it's going to be in a soup, in the protoplasm soup of the cell. And he says it's got to pick up then, depending on its bonding structures, it's going to pick up nucleic acids that are going to match the ones that came apart. And so he said, what you're doing is you're just, when that happens, you're increasing the energy level of that division, and so it will only pick up its proper the nucleic acid that it should pick up. And he says it won't pick up. He says all the food colorings and taste preservatives and taste enhancers and he says the 100,000 things that are in that cell right now that should not be in there.
Right.
And so he says that's why he's saying that people are taking the water. He's been noticing that over time they get stronger and stronger, and they get just more virile. I mean, got 70-year-old, 75-year-old patients that he has down in that area that he says have immune functions like they're 30 years old.
Right.
And after a couple of months, he said they just keep getting better. So so it has to be something. I believe it's a fundamental charge. He's saying, it may also affect the Krebs cycle. And so consequently, you get more ATP production from the mitochondria. And so you know, because you notice a lot of people say, "Wow, I got so much more energy. I wake up in the morning, and I used to want to just go back to bed, and now I get up and I just face the world and blah, blah, blah." And they go on and talk about how much more energy they have. Well, they may have more energy. They may have more ATP production in their body. That's something that we should be able to determine here within the next
year. I can put you in touch with somebody that can help you with that.
Oh, I love that, because we're looking for someone. We've got about four or five things going right now in different universities, but the problem is always two is just the... We're always just so strapped for cash. We're looking at how we're going to fund this next piece.
My cousin is Doug Wallace, who is the geneticist who really discovered mitochondrial stuff.
Hmm.
So, you know, if you look him up, you'll see. He's like the world's expert in mitochondrial genetics. So
he has his own
labs. So, you know, I probably should just get you two in touch because I'm sure he would have use for this.
Yeah. Let's definitely talk with him.
Right. So that is a real interesting theory. I think that, and I agree with you, it has to be something very, very basic and affecting not only maybe cleaning up the DNA, but also detoxing it at an intracellular level and, you know, perhaps increasing cell-to-cell communication, all of which are the mechanisms that go awry when you develop cancer. I mean, these are all fairly well shown. So it's a real exciting find, and I guess you just have to kind of stay below the radar in terms of the
talking on the radio might not be the best idea, but the reality is, after a while, you go, you just got to talk about it. You know, we just had too many people have success with it, and it's a
too many
it's
people
not a
suffering.
Drug. It's not a curative agent. We didn't start this to try to, you know, let's come up with a scheme to sell people something.
No.
It was just we kind of fell into the discovery of it. And I couldn't make that much of it just a few years ago. I mean, it'd take me 15 minutes to make 15 milliliters of it.
Right.
And so Yin's old friend, a friend of mine, he was the chair of physics at Sun Yat-sen. He came and spent a year or so with me, and we spent in the lab, and we came up with a way to actually manufacture the stuff in large quantities. So finally now we can...
So do you have a website people can go to if they're interested in learning more about this?
It would probably be doublehelixwater.com.
Mm-hmm.
That was been up for a year or so. I know that we've worked with a group in California called Cobalt and Cobalt Distribution, and we're just trying to... We don't want to become a sales company, and Ian and I are you know, we want to continue our research, and so we're trying to get them to take over the U.S. and try to you know, move some water so we can. We've got 10 things we want to do with probably 100 things we want to find out about this water particle. But one thing we do know about it is water. We can analyze it.
Right.
From now to doomsday, and it is a water particle. It is not, it's not anything else. It's just water, but it has a dramatic effect on people's health, and has for for 5 years now. We've had just stuff I'd love to just talk about all day, but I can't talk about it. They tell me they'll put me in jail.
All right.
So anyway.
Oh well, bleeding on the cutting edge.
Yeah. I don't know. The cutting edge is sometimes a little too sharp, though, I think.
That's right, it is.
For a while, you turn around and go, wow, that did cut me, you know.
Yeah, the whole system is set up so that anybody who wanders too far outside the box gets sometimes put in another box altogether called prison.
Yeah.
if you study history.
Yeah, they're it's a little violent at times, too. But
They can be.
But in the end, you know, you got to go, you know, what are you, you know, this is something...
A man or a mouse?
Yeah, a man or a mouse, and after a while you got to look at, you know, well, what's the greatest good? And the greatest good mm-hmm. definitely is the... Ian and I kind of stood back for 10 years or so and didn't say a word because every time we peeped, we were shot at. And so finally we said, screw it.
Well, I'm glad you're talking now. And like I said, if there's any other things you want to bring out about this water, just email me and I'll get you right back on the show because, I think it's great. I live to interview people such as yourself who are exploring beyond the boundaries.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Well, it's good. It's nice to have a place to talk from and someone to talk to. So that's definitely okay with me.
Well, great. Well, this is Temple of Health Radio Show. We've had a wonderful interview with David Gann, who, along with his co-author Xu Ying Lo, has written a book called Double Helix Water, and in it is. About at least a half of it is scientific papers and studies and hardcore science about this new structured water that they're just beginning to explore. And if you want to give your website one more time, David, it's doublehelixwater.com. Is that right?
Yeah, doublehelixwater.com.
And I had looked on the internet before, and it's the water is also for sale. So you can explore that as you go through the website and give it a try. It's water, so it's not toxic, and it appears to have a great number of potential health benefits, including maybe increasing cell communication, detoxing, and perhaps cleaning up our DNA, which we're in dire need of. Well, David, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate you talking with us today.
All right. Thank you, Susan. Thank you very much for having us, or having me.
You're welcome. This is Dr. Susan Kalb. Join us next week with Dr. Norm Shealy. His new book, Energy Medicine, Practical Applications and Scientific Proof. Norm also wrote the introduction and the foreword to this book that we've been interviewing David on. And in January, we're going to be interviewing Jeremy Bennett, Intuitive Strategy Counseling. And then we have Dr. Andrew Campbell on later in January, The Health Effects of Mold and Fungi, The Real Story. Dr. Campbell just gave up his medical license at the request of the Texas Medical Board. He's now an editor of a journal. And Dr. Campbell is one of the leading experts on mold, and mold is another politically incorrect topic because of the powers that be, and we'll explore that as well. This is Dr. Susan Kalb, the Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.